Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen. I'm talking to Beryl Bainbridge this evening about her novel Every Man for Himself. And we're really pleased to have Beryl here for the first book club in this, what is it, svelte new building, I think you have to say. New building. And I suppose I wanted to start by saying that it's something lots of reviewers and critics have pointed out, actually, but that there seem to be a sort of shift in your novels from novels which were, I guess, kind of not always contemporary, but quite often domestic or local and perhaps with elements of autobiography in, to historical novels, of which this is one. And not just historical novels, but sort of great British disasters as well.
Yes, yes.
So we've got the Titanic, we've got the Crimean War, we've got Scott and the Antarctic. And I just wonder what the special sort of relish was for you of the historical material, and not just the historical material, but these stories of sort of rather disastrous events.
Well, as far as the mystery about disasters, I can say it sounds complicated, this, but the reasons I became interested in disasters, I'd always been interested in them, and in all of my novels, there's usually a death anyway, a sudden death. I don't go into particularly into why it happened or what, but there is something. And there's a perfectly good reason for that, in that when I was at school, at the end of the war, all children from the age of 7 right up to the 6th form, we were marched to the Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool, and we were shown the troops going into Belsen or Buchenwald, one of the concentration camps. And to see, nothing was explained. We weren't told why this had happened. We knew when it had happened. And it had an incredible effect on me. I suppose it turned my mind in a way, so that life wasn't what it was supposed to be. Life is always full of horrors and mysteries and reasons why people behave like that. So that was the reason for doing about disasters. But the other reason, why going into history, why I was suddenly interested in history, was something quite different. It was the fact that I'd worked for a publisher for years, writing about, you say, part fiction, partly made up. But I don't think I ever made anything up. I only used characters I knew, mostly, say, my mother and my father, my brother, my aunts, myself. And I'd put a plot in the middle. But I wasn't interested in making anything up. I was just wanting to tell the story of my life, you know, the story of that all-around one. I mean, I had a childhood, a slightly puzzling childhood, in that my father had been a very rich man, not very rich, but he'd been very well off in business. He'd sold diamonds in Holland and all sorts of things. And then the slump of 1929 came, and my mother, they'd just got married, and my mother had married him on the rebound, thinking she was going into a life of luxury. And suddenly he was a bankrupt. So that when my brother and I were born, life was entirely different. You know, we moved from this huge house in a place called the Wirral, which is a posh part of Liverpool, and we moved to a place called Formby, which is down the railway line between Liverpool and Southport. And so that's all I was interested in writing about, nothing else at all. And I suppose by the time I got to this business of having to write something different for Duckworth, I wasn't writing it for Duckworth, I was writing it for someone else. But by the time I had to change the sort of things I was writing about, I'd used up all the things about my childhood and my parents. I hadn't anything else left to write about, frankly. You know, it had all been done. And anyway, this was about 12 or 13 books later, so I was older, and different things were more interesting. So that's why I went into the history.
And this particular bit of history, the Titanic and this voyage and this sort of Edwardian period. Mm. And you even make it, in a way, perhaps more challenging for yourself by having a narrator who's, although being born in Britain, being brought up in America. Yes. So that's another kind of strangeness. Yes. Yes. I mean, what do you, how did you go about kind of getting in inside that? Were you very strict with yourself about, you know, what words he's allowed to use?
Well, in a way, but because he was, I mean, I made him into an American because I'd done lots of English people before. So I thought, you know, it'd be better make him an American, because there were an awful lot of Americans on the Titanic anyway. And because it was 1912 and he'd be about 25 or getting on for 30, don't forget, the language didn't alter a great deal. I mean, my father spoke a language, English language, of the, 1800s, and it only changed after the war. So apart from saying sure or the Lord knows or something, I didn't have to worry about the way the Americans spoke. So that was the reason for having him. Yes.
And what about the actual sort of stuff? I mean, did you, there's lots of stuff about the Titanic, isn't there? I mean, did you find, so it was kind of the business of doing the research? And
well, I don't actually, I wouldn't say I'm a great researcher. I mean, I don't travel anywhere. I did go to, the Science Museum to look at the, there's the boiler or whatever it is. It's not the Titanic boiler, but it's the thing, a replica of what would have been in the Titanic. You know, this huge, beautiful, brass, magnificent boilers, you know. So I looked at that. There was a wonderful exhibition on at the time as well about the contents, some of the contents they'd brought up from below, which again was not unlike, you know, the Holocaust thing, because there were masses of shoes and bits of bits of clothing and that sort of thing. But you should never trust newspapers at the time, rather like now. They don't half muck up the story. So there's one book written by an American who was on the journey, a soldier, who wrote a very good, strictly factual account of what was going on. But then when you went into more and more detail, in books of the time, nothing to do with now, or I forget where I got the real details of what was wrong with the Titanic. I mean, it never seems to mention that the fact is that the Titanic should never have set sail. It was dangerous while it was in dock. It was apparently, when the coal floods down into the boilers to get the engine going, there's always a small, the friction starts a bit of a fire, and then you hose it and it goes out. But in this particular case, because there'd been a coal strike and because all the ships were laid up in dock, the White Star Line was so keen to get the liner out that, you know, the seaworthy things were signed and off she went, and there was this fire burning down below, and it burnt for 2 or 3 days. And when you think that the metal, I've forgotten now what it was actually made of, the hulk or whatever it's called, but when you think that was heated abnormally, and then it enters, you know, the icy waters of the Atlantic, no wonder it was weakened. So when it hit the iceberg, and again, when you read about in the newspapers, reading in the newspapers, you'd have thought there was just this one awful iceberg. And why, you know, why didn't the men in the attic or whatever it is, why didn't they see
Thomas,
it?
Do you know that Thomas Hardy poem where God's making an iceberg one side of the world and we're making a ship the other, and they're coming together?
Exactly. But there were many of them. All the ships in the Atlantic at the time had dropped anchor. They were all aware of the dangers, but not the Titanic. And it was those sort of details that I suppose it's fascinating, again, that, of course, nobody on board knew they were going to die, you know, but from a writer's point of view, if you're writing about a whole pile of people going on a voyage and you know that they're doomed, or a lot of them are doomed, that's the fascination of writing.
But doesn't, and doesn't, I mean, I've sort of wrote a column rather based on this premise, so don't correct me too brutally if
I'm wrong.
But doesn't, well, doesn't, isn't also one of the, you've chosen to have a first person narrator and quite an unusual one in some ways, and doesn't he sort of, I mean, he sort of knows they're doomed, doesn't he, in order to be able to write the story? I mean, even though he doesn't say it, he's not like one of those, you know, one of those Dickens narrators who says, and or we will see.
No, no, I suppose, you see, I always think of the narrator, and certainly this one is in the I, the first person. So I suppose, yes, of course, I knew that the ship was going to sink, I as this young American, because I'm telling the story. And that's another difficult thing, you see, I've just thought of this. Is if you're going to have a story about a disaster like that, the person telling the story can't go down with the ship.
No, no.
So that exactly. You have.
But he even says, it's unfair because I've been swatting away on this, but he even says, and I would contend, you see, you cunningly have him say, he says a couple of times things like, he says about one of the other characters, who's a. An acquaintance of him, because he seems to know half the rich people on the ship. He says he had the face of a child. That's the way it says he has ..
Yes,
he had. You know, in the way that people talk about somebody whom they has died and they for a second forgotten.
These hints of what may happen or is going to happen.
There's this plot, in a way, this story that sort of everybody knows except the characters, apart from the narrator. But then I wanted to ask you about sort of all these other things. I was described in the green room, as it were, the novel to Beryl before we started, as one in which all the sort of plot sort of happens behind the events are ostensibly happening. And you start it there's a prologue, which perhaps we could come to in a second, but after a prologue, the novel starts with this sort of extraordinary episode, which, if you're reading it for the first time, you think, what on earth has this got to... Hi, this is about the Titanic, I know about this. What is this all about? With the narrator recalling a man having a heart attack in Manchester Square in central London and handing him a photograph. I mean, that's what...
that episode of the man having the heart attack or collapsing, I was in a taxi going around Manchester Square and looked out the window and there was this man slumped against the railings. And I was about to say to the driver, look, stop, 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 and he just drove on. But anyway, a woman came out anyway. And I just went on imagining what would happen if I'd have been walking down the road and I'd seen this man slump against the railings, and what would he do and what would he say? And it was that set it off, because of the trouble about writing any novel, any work of fiction, is always the beginning. I mean, how do you start the damn thing? You know, it's got to be so immediate, the first few lines or pages, that people will want to go on reading it. And so it's that's the difficulty. And you can't just start by saying, I went down to Southampton and boarded the Titanic. It doesn't work like that.
Well, some people would have done something a bit like that, I think.
Well, maybe that's why I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, because it's peculiar, because I think, not always, but quite often novelists that I've talked to in the Guardian Book Club will say about a novel, particularly if it's a first-person narrative, that the voice of the novel came to them before the story.
Yes.
But in a sense, that can't be true of this novel.
No, it
the story's there.
Yes.
And it's a strange thing, I think, strange and rather wonderful thing, that there's this, it's going to be about the Titanic. You start very indirectly, and then it's as if all the incidental plotting about the narrator is what takes up your fascination. Yes. You know, the ship's steaming on, you know what's going to happen eventually. Yes. But meanwhile, there are these mysteries about paintings he's stolen from his uncle's house, a man who's died in the street.
But all those sort of things, I don't, I, I, it's a long while ago now since I wrote it, so I can't quite remember. But you don't... When you're writing something, you use an awful lot of things that have happened to you, not the year before, that are happening to you at the time. For instance, there's the thing of the painting, the Cézanne painting. I mean, I'd been married to a painter. I don't mean I know anything about paintings, but so that paintings were in my head anyway. So all sorts of little details that... And also reading an immense amount of... I have a huge selection of books on murder, not fictional murder. They're Famous Trials, a series called Famous Trials, which came up for auction about 20 or 25 years ago. It was, in fact, it was, I'm showing off now, but it was Betjeman, John Betjeman, who knew I had an interest in crime, not in crime, in things like that, and said, you know, there's this auction going on, there's this sale going on. And I think I got about 25 volumes for about £10 of, you know, all famous murders. And they're not... they're not stories, they're the actual trials, you know, what the prosecutor and the other side said. So that all comes into it.
And is that where you got, there's a sort of subplot, there's always subplots. Yes. There's the subplot about the man in the boarding house who has deposited the narrator as a child in an orphanage, yes, in Manchester. And this rather mysterious character, Scurrer, who, yes, seems to know everybody. As somebody, yes, said, he knows everybody. He knows these kind of details about his child. And this, there's been a murder, and the man who took him to the orphanage has actually, it turns out, he was hanged for the murder of the old lady in the boarding house, yes, who took him in.
Well, a lot of that, it doesn't explain this very well, but a lot of that is to do that when you're a child, there's all sorts of things going on outside, probably in the newspapers, that your parents talk about, you know, and that you only half hear or half understand. And there's things like people being found hanged and God knows what else, and it goes on and on. Now, as for the character of Scurrer, that was somebody I knew anyway. Yeah. And so I based...
It was a real
person, yes. I hope I disguised it. There were one or two people since have said they think they knew who he was. And Scurrer was, in real life, he was such a clever man. He knew so much that it was easy to make him into a character. He didn't have to explain what he was going on about.
Yeah.
He was just the intellectual at large, you know.
He is sort of, I was going to ask you about the prologue, and there he is in the prologue. The prologue is rather
yes,
wonderful because
it, glasses.
Yes.
What?
The prologue is a passage that we do literally come to. We even come to some of the phrases you use in it right at the end of the novel. And the prologue is the last time it seems.
Shall I read it a bit? It's only tiny.
Yes, go on, yes.
15th of April, 1912. He said, save yourself if you can. And I said, firmly enough, though I was trembling and clutching at straws, I intend to. Will you stand at my side? To which he replied, remember, Morgan, not the height, only the drop is terrible. Then he walked away, gait unsteady, the cord of his robe trailing the deck. And then it goes on. Then towards the end, it's, I fancy he was smiling, but I can't be sure. Possibly I need to believe it ended that way so that I can expel from my ears the ululation of grief which later pierced the glittering heavens. The night was so still, the sea so calm, the moment so out of step with the catastrophe in progress that I made to join him, fluttered the fingers of my raised hands as though we were both guests at a social function, and as if it was the most natural thing in the world to acknowledge the presence of a friend. I remember looking down at my right shoe, still inexplicably shiny with polish, as I prepared to take a stride towards that figure braced against the rail. Then the water, first slithering, then tumbling, gushed us apart. I've suddenly remembered, you see, that remember, Morgan, not the height, only the drop, is terrible. I think that's a line, except for the Morgan, out of Schopenhauer. I think it's a yes. Because what one uses that as well. I mean, there's a wonderful Schopenhauer book I've got at home, which gives bits out of all the things he wrote and stuff about life. And I think at one point he does say, remember, not the height or whatever it says. So that's why it's there. Again, there's no deep inner meaning.
No, it's not an inner meaning. Yeah. But it's when you wrote it, it for the reader, yeah, at the end of the novel, by the, yes, end of the novel, it's sort of completely understandable what that is. But, yes, in the prologue itself, you know, it tells, yes, us, does some jobs at the beginning of novels, do you tell us who, yes, the narrator's name, who, yes, he is. But, yes, who is this bloke? You don't know who this bloke is.
Yeah, but I know.
No, I know. But it does what a prologue quite often does. It's one of the reasons I think detective novelists, yes, often like prologues. I think, yes, the first prologue in English fiction, I think, which was labelled prologue, was in The Moonstone.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And so often they set up little puzzles which then have to be solved. Yes. But you do like to set up a puzzle because we don't know who this sententious figure in a bathrobe or a dressing gown or whatever is at all, or why we've been given him until much sort of later.
But I think I do that. I've done it in other ones. I think it's just to arouse attention. It's just to make somebody think, well, what the hell is going to happen after this? Maybe it's that reason. I mean, I don't do it deliberately, I don't think. I think the structure of a novel, the way it progresses, is the most important thing about a novel. You've got to have, it's not so much the beginning, the middle, and the end. That's terribly important as well. But it does help if you have a structure where, for instance, in two or three other books, I've started, you write, say, 6 pages of a story, and then you cut it in half, and the first bit is the beginning. And then you go to the whole story, and then you return to the other half of that beginning. And I've done that lots of times. It just helps, it helps me to write. That's the reason I do
it's
it.
It's a tease as well, surely it is. Well, and you do lots of these things, you know, I like the tease. Yeah. The painting you mentioned, when he takes the painting, and he takes it on page 5, it's quite early on.
Yes.
And he steals it, and it's in the aftermath of this sort of this event, the death in Manchester Square, which has ended with the man saying, the man who dies, the finger stroke of love, he said, quite distinctly, and soon after died. And, you know, call me naive reader, but I think, the finger stroke of love, what's that? And gratifyingly, on page 124, I find out what it is. So you were teasing. And when he takes the picture, it says, I went immediately to Prince's Gate, packed my overnight bag, and leaving open the leaded window of my room to shift the tobacco smoke, closed the door quietly behind me. I paused in the corridor, did what I intended to do. It took me but a moment. Brushed the square of dust away with my sleeve and went to the head of the stairs. I'm sure I'm being teased there because, first of all, I think, did what I intended to do. He could have told me. He hasn't told me. But he's given me a clue, brushed away, or she's given me a clue, brushed the square of dust away. And if I was a clever reader, I would sort of know. I would be able to guess.
But if I'd have said why he did that, what he was doing.
Did what I intended. He would have said, many a narrator would have said, I took the painting.
Yes.
I took the painting.
Yes.
But this narrator says, did what I intended.
I did what I had to. Yeah, but that's because you don't want to give it away too quickly. I mean, it's nothing to do with suspense. maybe it's because I know what he was doing, so I didn't have to bother explaining it to anybody else till later on.
Yes. You know? But it's also the narrator knew what he was doing, so he's not going to explain.
Well, that's what I mean, the narrator me, yes. So he didn't have to tell anybody else. Why bother? Except it was quite important.
Yes.
I can't remember now why the painting was so important.
But it's his mother. It's his mother.
Oh yes.
And that's.
Is it?
And so much of the sort of little the puzzles in the book are about his own rather peculiar.
Yeah.
Childhood. Yes, I mean, we talked about the murder, but
exactly.
and how he's sort of related to very rich people, but actually has had a childhood where he's been sort of plucked, hasn't he, from, you know,
exactly.
like a sort of like the foundlings in traditional fiction.
He's well, I had to have a character that came from a so-called rich background, because always before I've written about people who, you know, have been born in Liverpool or somewhere. So I was. That was a change, but I don't think there's any deeper motive than that. And the fact that he knew all about that he'd suffered deaths and dreadful things happening.
Mm.
I had a feeling that most people round about 1912 they had backgrounds like that.
Yeah, you know, create this incredible sense of a narrator who sort of. Sometimes rather casually mentions, you know, things which, if they'd happened in my life, I would either never talk about or talk about all the time.
Oh, but John, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
He's got to be real. I mean, just because you're writing a book doesn't mean you have to explain every damn thing. I suppose what it is that I don't think I often write a book for anybody else but me. Mm. If I understand it, it seems to me all right. That's wrong, but still. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I think lots of novelists would say they write only for themselves. I think it's probably true with you. I think not always. It's not always true. I think that you know that some. I don't know. Do you think novelists sometimes find it a bit difficult to fess up to the fact that they might do some? You know, I mean, Dickens did it quite sort of. I mean, and Fielding did as well. They wanted to sort of. They were made no bones about the fact that they were trying to please lots of
people.
Readers, and you know.
Yes, exactly.
And I think quite a lot of novelists really. But it's become sort of bad form almost.
I mean, book writing is so different now from the time when you know, well, certainly from the time of Dickens, but you know, and writing is very much more different nowadays. You know, you're not, unless you're extremely lucky or very brilliant, you're not going to zoom up into you know, enormous status as a novelist, because you know, book reading is getting less and less. You know, now we've got whatever those things are called, pods or whatever you mentioned before. Whatever that is.
But that's all readers listening to the way. Anyway.
No, but it's not the same as writing the
words.
Well,
let me ask you something else about the narrator and the sort of the sense that one gets from him of kind of sort of, yes, deaths and distress and suffering sort of just off the picture. There's a lot of drinking in the novel. A lot of drinking.
Yes.
Amount of drinking.
But
also, I mean, it's actually, I was thinking about that first episode, and only sort of third time through the novel, I notice the thing that Morgan says about this man and his behaviour, and he says as he collapses and he gives him this photograph.
Yeah.
He grabs him and the narrator says, "I tried to free myself, but the man was drowning. His face was so close that his two eyes merged into one. I had thought he was drunk, yet his breath smelled sweet." And in the spirit of a kind of very diligent essay writer, I mean, there's stuff about drinking and drunkenness
through. I think in the case of that man slumped by the railings, all the people I've ever seen slumped by railings are drunk.
But also it's as if Morgan presumes that people might, you know, it's a kind of natural condition almost for the people he encounters.
Well, I think at the time I was writing this book, most of the people I encountered were falling down the railway. You know, lots of people drank like hell, you know. But nothing, you know, well, I suppose. No, but.
He drinks a brandy at breakfast in Southampton just before he sets off, doesn't he? He says, "Oh, I'm going to be very good on this voyage and I'm going to play lots of squash." Yes. Do they have a squash court on the Titanic?
I don't know.
They'd
have a room. I think they did.
And I'm going to get really fit and I'm going to eat moderately and I'm not going to drink at all.
Yes.
And then he says something like, this thought made me so shaky that I ordered a brandy.
Well, I suppose at the time I was writing, most of the people I knew, that's how one, particularly in publishing, that's how one lived.
So that's not a sort of Edwardian...
Well, I suppose they did it then as well, you know. And if you've got money, I suppose it's a lot different. And if you're shy, it helps to have a drink if you're going to mingle. I don't mean Morgan wasn't at all shy.
Yeah.
But certainly, I mean, I went on a cruise. I did a lecture tour on a cruise about 10 years ago or something. And everybody was drinking their heads off the whole time. That was the point.
Yeah, yeah.
The drink was freer. Well, some of the drink was free. So, of course, people drank. You know, it's part of the joy of...
Shipboard life.
Exactly, yeah.
It's time, I'm sure. Yes, gentlemen. In the middle, yes.
Whether love exists seems to be a bit of a question in Morgan's head, and from the behaviour seems to witness it doesn't seem to exist in the novel. Although there is the example of the elderly couple who decide to stay in the deck chairs as the ship goes down together. Well, I wondered whether you thought that love exists or not.
Well, I didn't quite get
Morgan that. seems to believe or perhaps learn that love doesn't exist.
Yeah.
He has. He has an infatuation and is forced to see that this woman is actually carrying on with somebody else. And there's, except the gentleman said there's perhaps one counterexample, the old couple who are sort of prepared to kind of go down together. Yes. In fact,
they're real though. That I don't know whether they really did love each other. Well, they must have done. They were over and over again. They've been put forward as examples. But don't forget, they were so old, would it matter?
So it's, do you share the sort of narrator's disenchantment
about love? I suppose so, yes, I suppose. No, deep down inside, one always believes, but
yes,
never really experienced it.
Because you actually, if I may add my featherweight to your question, he actually gets told by Molly, who is a Guggenheim's mistress. All these men have mistresses, don't they?
Yes.
And she's his mistress, and she says something to Morgan, like Morgan's sort of saying, you know, isn't it sort of awful knowing that you're going to get the heave-ho soon?
Yes.
And she says, oh, well, you know, being a mistress to a rich man is okay.
Yeah.
It'd be being a mistress to a poor man that would be terrible.
Yeah.
And Morgan says to her, but what if it were true love? And she says, there's nothing true about love.
Yes, well, no, I think I was just being deliberately peculiar there. No, I do think there's such a thing as true love. I think it wears off, but I think...
Scar also says that love is only something that women
What?
He says, you have Skura saying that love is something that only women feel, the questioner says.
Well, that's not true. But I think it's only women that talk about it, you know, to that extent. I don't think men talk about it like that. I think it's all tangled up with the way women are brought up to think about men. And so... I don't think it's a bad thing that men don't go on about love. I think it's probably rather a good idea.
But you do give Skura, we're supposed to call him Skura, not Skura. Skura, you do give him quite a lot of, you said, like the person on whom he's based, you give him a good deal of authority.
Yes.
I mean, he does say these things from the Schopenhauer onwards.
Yes, yes.
And they're kind of great big pebbles dropped into the narrative.
Yeah.
And... And he has a certain role correcting the narrator. You know, the narrator's got Marxist fantasies, hasn't he? He says, "Well, I'd like to be rich, so I can sort of give it all away." And Skura says, "Well, everywhere people just hate you for that, especially the people you give it to." And and you give him, including giving him the line, "Every man for himself." I mean, you give him a certain weight to that kind of, I don't know, perhaps rather cynical or solipsistic.
I don't think it's cynical. I think certain men, particularly that one, when he spoke, one listened to what he said. You know, one thought he knew what he was saying, that's all. Now, it may be that lots of people who've been to universities and all sorts of things know lots of people that can say that sort of thing, but I didn't particularly. So when you meet somebody who does talk in that very strange way, you take notice, or it inspires you in a funny way. Did I see Kate Winslet?
Yes.
Yeah, the big Titanic film.
Yes. What, there was a Titanic? Yeah, oh, that one where they were on the deck.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the American film?
Yeah, yeah.
Was that the same one?
Yeah, that's the same one that Beryl was talking about earlier.
Yes.
About
it,
where
oh,
she didn't
yes.
like the fact oh, that smoke was coming out
besides,
of all the funnels.
But listen, you nobody could stand there. That was ridiculous. One, that you wouldn't be allowed, you know. And two, you'd have been blown over. What the was doing? And anyway, he was too young for her.
So. Well, with that irrefutable judgment, I just want to say Beryl will sign some books for anybody who
if you've
wants.
Got any. Yes.
And they have. And
just
to say,
have.
Just to thank Beryl very much for coming and talking.
Thank you.
To
thank you. What water.